I'm Faith Mitchell, President and CEO of Grantmakers in Health. It's my pleasure to present this podcast of the 2015 Terrence Keenan Leadership Award in Health Philanthropy Acceptance Speech. This year's recipient is Dr. Gail Christopher, Vice President for Policy and Senior Advisor at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. GIH established the Terrence Keenan Award in 1993 in honor of Terrence Keenan, a founder of GIH and a remarkable grantmaker whose vision, values, and humility inspire philanthropy to this day. The Terrence Keenan Award honors outstanding health grantmakers whose work is distinguished by leadership, innovation, and achievement. Dr. Christopher's commitment and work toward creating a healthy and equitable nation embody the spirit of the Terrence Keenan Award. Here's her speech, All Lives Matter, with introductory remarks by Robert Hughes, President and CEO of the Missouri Foundation for Health.
Thank you, Faith, and good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to add my welcome to Faith's to today's Terrence Keenan Award presentation. This afternoon, we'll be recognizing Gail Christopher, Vice President for Policy and Senior Advisor at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, who will receive the 2015 Terrence Keenan Leadership Award. The Terrence Keenan Leadership Award honors outstanding individuals in the field of philanthropy whose work is distinguished by leadership, innovation, and achievement. First awarded in 1993, the Leadership Award reflects Terry Keenan's unique contributions over more than four decades in health philanthropy. The selection committee has a challenging job in choosing from among many deserving nominees. Let me acknowledge this year's committee and thank them for their work. So as I call your name, if you could please stand. Len McNally from the New York Community Trust chaired the committee. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today. Ned Colone, the Colorado Trust. Richard Figueroa, the California Endowment. Eric Kelly, the Quantum Foundation. Brenda Sharp, the Reach Healthcare Foundation. Francis Sheehan, Brandywine Health Foundation. And Alan Smart, the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust. Please join me in thanking the committee. It's a real privilege to introduce Gail Christopher. Gail is a remarkable leader whose contributions are broad, deep, and enduring. Gail was nominated by three leaders of America Healing, an initiative of the Kellogg Foundation. The joint nominators are Kathy Ko Chin, who is here today, President and CEO of the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum, Jacqueline Peta, Executive Director of the National Congress of American Indians, and Janet Mergia, President and CEO of the National Council of La Raza. It's fitting that Gail's nomination was a group effort by three women of color in national leadership positions. As the nomination stated, Gail's work has brought together major health, equity, and racial justice leaders from around the nation and facilitated cross-racial discussions and healing. Gail Christopher's vision of a healthier, more equitable America is based on her deep commitment to comprehensive approaches to well-being. Let me highlight a few examples. While at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, she developed and implemented Place Matters, which has become a national model for community-driven, evidence-based health action to eliminate disparities. Also at the Joint Center, she was the force behind the work of the Dellums Commission, which brought together representatives from many sectors to examine the impact of public policies in education, health, and juvenile justice on the well-being of young men of color. The Dellums Commission helped influence and redefine the narrative on race in this country, and we see its influence today in My Brother's Keeper initiative. At the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, Gail spearheaded the America Healing initiative. As her nomination letter noted, the combination of addressing racial equity and combating structural racism with healing is unique. Linking racial equity to health ensures real change as we learn more and more about how social and environmental and structural determinants impact health. These three initiatives highlight Gail's unique contributions to health philanthropy. She has seeded the field with big, important, fundamental ideas and related practices. Ideas like the centrality of place on the connections between race and health. the consequences of pervasive inequity on the health of boys and men of color, and the power of healing to promote racial equity and combat structural racism. These are ideas that invite people to act together to better the lives of others, and through their shared action, give meaning to their own lives. I had the pleasure of knowing and working with Terry Keenan, and Gail and Terry share two special qualities I'd like to point out. First, humility. Terry was a genuinely humble person, and his selflessness was remarkable given his wisdom and talents. So it is with Gail. Second is tenacity. Those who mistook Terry's quiet, respectful demeanor as a lack of intensity would soon realize he was a force to be reckoned with. Gail, too, is a quiet and unrelenting force, urgently striving for the well-being of all Americans, grounded in a progressive vision of what our country could be. So it's my distinct pleasure to introduce Gail Christopher and present her with the 2015 Terrence Keenan Leadership Award. Gail.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for that gracious and generous introduction, Bob. And thank you to the committee and to my nominators, my sisters. I am so touched, so moved. And I'm really glad this isn't the Academy Awards, so they don't put the hook out or turn up the music while I'm thanking people. I have so many people to thank. You don't get to a position like this. You don't get to be privileged to do this kind of work without relationships and partnerships, friendships and leadership. And so I must thank the team of people from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation who are here today. Would you all stand up and be acknowledged, please? I share this recognition with each of you. I must also thank and acknowledge our amazing board of directors that had the courage to support a commitment to becoming the most effective anti-racist organization they could be that promotes racial equity. They created the authorizing environment at a board level, and that's essential. I must thank the person who hired me and who allowed me to lead, who is now here with us today. He's the former president of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, Sterling Spearin. I must thank Lejeune Montgomery Tabron, who could not be here today, but who is the current president of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, who is wholly committed to this work. So join me in thanking and applauding our president, Lejeune Montgomery Tabron. The honor of being recognized by my peers for my life's work and indeed my life's joy, I really can't quite find words to express how appreciative I am and how touched I am. And I will not cry. I'd like to say that the title of my talk today is simply, All Lives Matter. All lives matter. And when it gets to a point where that's in question, be it anywhere in the world, or certainly here in this country, we have to dig deep and find out what's driving that notion. Invariably, it's a set of beliefs, beliefs that somehow give permission to devalue the great gift of human life. In this country, that set of beliefs is part of the DNA. It's embedded in our Constitution. And I actually learned that, I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I learned about the Boston Tea Party and, you know, all of that founding of America. There's a new book, a very scholarly book based on primary sources that's called Slave Nation. And it describes how this nation, the colonies, actually came together to be one nation in order to perpetuate and maintain the right to enslave African Americans. Things were happening in England that said, there are rights for these human beings. And this country responded, and we weren't even a country then, we were just colonies, by saying, let's unite to protect. So the South and the North said, we got to work together because we got to be able to keep this going. So when we talk about this thing being embedded, it really is 4 centuries at least. And what is this thing? It's this notion of a taxonomy of the human family. It's this absurd notion that was an 18th century notion of a hierarchy of human value based on physical characteristics. So how you look determines your place in this taxonomy. And of course, the people who created the taxonomy put themselves at the top. That's human nature, right? And they happened to be white males. And then they gradually listed all the groups that they felt existed and put, of course, the more color you had, you were at the bottom. Now, it's a false ideology, it's a false hierarchy, but because it happened at the time that the printing press was proliferating across the world, it really spread very rapidly and was embraced. And it was the permission, if you will, it undergirded the institutions of enslavement and annihilation of indigenous people and all sorts of things. Now, we have, in this country, tried to right those wrongs. We've had episodic attempts. We've had a civil rights movement. We had the Civil War. We had Reconstruction. We have treaties with Native American peoples. We have immigration laws. But the fundamental notion of a hierarchy of human value, that has never been addressed. And because it hasn't, we continue to see things like Ferguson, Missouri. How many of you saw the news about the report that was released yesterday? I listened to NPR, and so I heard about it early in the morning, right? And so the statement that was made was that there are 21,000 people in Ferguson. 16,000 have arrest warrants. And the reporter asked the question, well, was there any evidence of bias? So I believe, though, that we have within our power the capacity to undo the vestiges of that belief. I believe that the technology at our hands and at our disposal today could enable us to truly orchestrate the will and the resources to turn that belief upside down and jettison it in its entirety and embrace one another as equal human beings. Terence Keenan was a remarkable representative and contributor to the field of philanthropy, and particularly to health philanthropy. And in one of his papers that he wrote, he described a great foundation. He said a great foundation is informed by judgment, acts where there is a need to act, and it takes necessary risks and proceeds in the face of great odds. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, when the board decided to do this work, they recognized a need to act, and they proceeded in the face of great odds. When we started this work specifically, intentionally about racism, America was touted as post-racial. It was before President Obama even announced he would run for office. But we saw a need because our founder said, do what you will with the money so long as it helps children. And we looked at the population of children in this country who are today, not tomorrow, not 5 years from now, who are today predominantly children of color. And most of those children are growing up in low-income circumstances or poverty. And so it was to fulfill our founder's vision that we knew we had to get creative about addressing the undergirding inequity, which is structural as well as within hearts and minds. A little bit about my background. Some of you know that my doctorate is in a holistic health discipline called naturopathy. And it essentially focuses on manual medicine and on connective tissue. And there were some core principles that we learned in school that have guided my entire life's journey. And it has to do with the body's capacity to be self-healing. Its innate self-healing, self-maintaining, and self-regulatory capacities. Our education left me with a deep reverence and respect for the human body and for life. But the literal meaning of the word naturopathy is to fix or correct suffering. And the meaning of philanthropy is to work for the well-being of others. And so I feel like I'm still exercising my professional training in the field of philanthropy. But over the decades, that has been a journey. In Chicago, one of the first programs that I designed was called the Family Development Institute. And it was working with mothers who lived in public housing in Chicago. And it was an attempt to give them the skills and the resources and the capacities to cope with the stress of their environment. And as a part of that, we did the requisite blood tests for lead levels in the children. Now, there was one mother, and I'll never forget her. She had all three of her children tested. She lived in Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago. And she came to me after she got the results with tears in her eyes. And she said, "All of my children are broken because they all had elevated lead levels." Now here, 4 decades later, 1/3 of our nation's children still live in housing that puts them at risk for lead poisoning. Now, we've had all kinds of struggles and victories in this fight. We've gotten lead out of the gasoline, we've gotten it out of the paint, but we haven't gotten it out of the houses that these children live in because they're low-income communities. The fights to overcome the lead toxicity and the lead burdens hold a lot of lessons for us. And one of those lessons is when something becomes ubiquitous, it's easy to be in denial about it. Lead is a ubiquitous toxin, and we're still not doing what we must do to protect our children. The evidence is clear that there is no safe level of lead, none. Now that we've gotten it down to 5 micrograms per deciliter, down from what was 10, we're still not there. There is no safe level. But I often think of this lead challenge, and we worked hard. I was in those testimonies, and that was 4 years ago. We worked hard, and there were victories. But just like lead is a ubiquitous toxin that is destroying our children, the belief in a hierarchy of human value is a ubiquitous toxin that is destroying our children. But the question remains, how do these things have that impact? What is it that allows these dynamics that are not necessarily, well, in the case of lead, it is biochemical, it is biological, but how does the combination of limited opportunity and residential segregation, schools that don't have the proper investments, the absence of opportunity for early childhood education, how do these things create disease and impede the body? I believe the unifying concept is the stress, or as Bruce McEwen says now, it's funny how they change the language, right? And he describes the allostasis, which is the body's ability to change and still be the same. And the cumulative effect of demands for that change can often overwhelm the body and create what's called an allostatic load. Now, the good news is you can measure biochemically indicators when an individual has an excess allostatic load. But that idea of the fight or flight response was not designed to make us sick. It was designed to protect us. It was designed to enable us to see the danger and to escape the danger. But when the danger is always all around you, like it is for so many of our children today, there is no escape, and it results in a breakdown of the natural systems within the body. So I believe the work of philanthropy today is to first acknowledge that reality for so many millions of our nation's children and families, and fund efforts to mitigate the consequences of that reality while that reality is changing, and while we're funding efforts to change that reality as well. One of those things that helps to mitigate the effects of this exposure to chronic stress is something as fundamental as access to mother's milk for the first 6 months of life, exclusively. And that was another risk that the W.K. Kellogg Foundation took, to focus on optimizing breastfeeding levels in this country. Now, when we started that work, the focus was on the babies and the children. As it evolved, and we funded some of the researchers, we began to see amazing benefits for the mothers. They were protected against heart disease and cancer, and I even read an international article that said they were protected against retinal degeneration. So, of course, I'm looking for why. What's the mechanism in the act of breastfeeding that is protecting the mother against all manner of chronic degenerative disease? Well, we're beginning to understand that the hormones that are produced, the bonding hormone of oxytocin, as well as prolactin, are anti-anxiety hormones. They reduce stress. Now, surely a woman isn't breastfeeding her whole life, at least not today. She might have been in the 19th century. But today, how is it that such a short intervention can have such a powerful impact? It reminds us of the power of stress to create pathology and the power of mitigating or relieving stress to promote health. I read most of the speeches of past recipients of this great honor, and they talked about what foundations should do. They talked about ways that foundations should change. And I feel like I have to do a little of that, right? So I'm going to suggest that one of the things that the Kellogg Foundation has done, and I really give a lot of kudos to Sterling Spearin, who was president at the time, as well as his predecessors, they walk the talk. We have a very diverse staff. And we have a very diverse board of directors. That, I believe, is a requirement for effective philanthropy. And how you get to that is by being intentional and recognizing that it isn't easy, that the more people you hire of color, the more people who will leave who are of color, because it is not easy work. We also have to change our culture within the foundation. So we have the idea of respect for diversity, the idea of racial equity, built into our performance management system. Every employee at the Kellogg Foundation participates in development programs. And I think I've gotten this right. Is it the Intercultural Development Inventory? It's an inventory that's measured and graded psychologically, and it allows you as an organization, both individually and collectively, to look at where you are on a continuum of development, recognizing that overcoming this belief in racial hierarchy is a journey, and it is a lifetime journey. And none of us have gotten this down, none of us. I'll tell you a quick story because, you know, my kids tease me about this, and they say, Mom, you're the guru of this diversity stuff and multicultural stuff. Not really. I abhor violence. And so the only television I watch is HGTV, right? Why? You know, it used, when they started out, they were one of the most diverse channels on television. They've slipped a little on that. They've gotten this romance going on with these, you know, two men that lead everything. But we're going to have to write them letters and get them back on the good foot here. But if you watch enough HGTV, just like if you watch enough violence, it's going to become part of your experience. So, of course, I have to redo every room in the house, right? You know? And so I finally decided I had to redo my kitchen. Old house, you got to take the wall down. You know, you got to have open concept, right? You know? So, of course, if you're going to take the wall down, you have to be sure and determine whether it's load-bearing or not, right? So I had 5 different estimates from contractors. 3 said it was not load-bearing. 2 said it was. That's a problem, right? So I watched a few more episodes. And I got my flashlight, and I went down the basement, and I looked at the, whatever you call those things, right? But I knew what they were. And I looked at them, and they were going the right way, and I decided it was not load-bearing, so I hired somebody who agreed with me, right? And so I stayed home the day they were doing the demolition, you know, and as they were about to take the wall down, the foreman came and he said, well, what are you going to do to the man who was working on site? He said, what are you going to do if it's load bearing? He says, it's not load-bearing. He says, yeah, but what are you going to do if it is? He said, we've got a plan. We'll do this. We'll do that. So fine. So I run upstairs to pack because I have to go back to Battle Creek. My home is in Maryland. And as I'm upstairs packing, I kid you not, my house starts to do the Watusi. I hear this screeching and the house is shaking and I'm going, oh my God, what have they done? They've destroyed my house. I run outside and all the workmen are outside. I go, what have you done to my house? And they go, no, no, ma'am. Now this is Maryland. This is right outside of DC, right? They say, no, ma'am, it's an earthquake. Of course I put my hands on my hips. And I say, what kind of fool do you think I am? We don't have earthquakes in Washington, D.C. And the foreman, who was from Guatemala, he says, no, ma'am, really, really, it's an earthquake. Go turn on your TV. I go back in, and sure enough, 5.5 earthquake. But in that moment, all my prejudices, all my biases, all my fears about this Latino work crew surfaced. And I share that story with you because that's how bias works. We think that we're good. You know, we think that we're okay. But let a stress happen. Let a difficult situation arise, like these police officers who have, unfortunately, lethal force in their hands. And all those residual biases and prejudices that we have, they surface. Now, I humbly apologize to all the workers, and they did a wonderful job on my kitchen, and no, it was not load-bearing. But part of what surfaced in our work is the importance of learning to recognize and overcome our unconscious biases. We all have them, because that's how the brain works. I don't have to look at that chair and say, that chair has four legs and a seat and a back, it's a chair. No. My brain has created a schema, a pattern that says that's a chair. We've been bombarded with so many negative images and stereotypes about diverse groups that our brains have produced these schema, and they're called up just like that. But the good news is science is emerging and tools are emerging, and we can overcome our biases, and the first step in that process is the commitment to do that. And I'm very excited that some of the grantees that we're working with are doing amazing work, particularly in the field of policing and criminal justice. They are actually being invited into police departments, and they're working as social psychologists to help law enforcement admit, acknowledge, and overcome biases. Another lesson that we've learned in this work is the importance of agency and listening to the authentic voices of community, and working to create the conditions that allow communities to come together. One of our most exciting bodies of work is led by Kathy Ko Chin, and it's the Asian American Pacific Islander Health Forum. Now, there are a lot of stereotypes about the Asian American community being, you know, the model minority and all of that. But if you get past those stereotypes and you dig more deeply into the reality of the Asian immigrant experience, you see all sorts of inequities and disparities. It's a diverse community within its diversity. This group started out as 45 community health efforts. They're now over 1,000, and they collectively prepared amicus briefs for the Supreme Court in favor of the ACA, and that's agency, and that's collective action in its true sense. Other examples could be drawn from our Place Matters work, and one of the best stories there is the spreading of what started out as a small group of volunteers. They now have four networks in the state of New Mexico, and they stood up and prevented a toxic waste dump from being located in their community in Bernalillo. People lost their jobs because they stood up. And they're not paid to stand up. But I just want to communicate the power that's inherent in people coming together and getting just enough support to enable them to do that. I could go on and on about examples, and I just won't. I won't bore you to death. But over the years, I am affirmed and convinced that the stress of having one's humanity, one's core equality denied, the exposure to discrimination is at the root of health inequities and health disparities. And we can do all sorts of things to increase access to care. We can do all sorts of things to increase the quality of care. But what is missing is access to caring. We as a country must learn to care and to demonstrate that care, to believe that all lives matter. I was born with a physical challenge, which caused me to have multiple surgeries. And I think it was surgery number 23 or something, where the doctor said, it didn't work, we're going to have to do it again. Now, this surgery was on my eyes, and I was in tremendous pain, tremendous pain. If you've ever had a toothache, multiply that about 50 times. And I tried everything. I'd had 23 surgeries. I'd had all the medications. I tried acupuncture. I tried everything. But in that moment of desperation, I really, for the first time, cried out and asked for help from divine forces. I asked God to help me. And in that moment, I was in my 20s, I was impressed in my mind with these words. And they were as clear to me as my voice is to you. And the words were simply, love your eyes as they are loved. And for the first time in my life, I went to the mirror and I looked at myself with love. I looked at my eyes with love. And in that moment, the pain ceased. The condition was arrested for the next 30 years. And it became the light of my life, which is learning to love. We must learn as individuals to love ourselves, and that's sometimes a struggle for people of color and sometimes for women. But we must do this because we can't give what we don't have. So we must learn to love ourselves so that we can extend that love to others and truly become a healthy nation. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.